2 years ago, undocumented immigrants who had arrived in the United States as children gained special legal status. President Obama's DACA program, as it was called, allowed these immigrants to get jobs and driver's licenses without fear of deportation. But the program did not give these young immigrants any right to become citizens. Research has shown that the program has benefited many young immigrants, but the benefits are not evenly spread. And Nevada lags behind some communities in states like California. About 87% of applicants in Nevada have been approved, compared to nearly 100% in some California cities. Iridani Sanchez came to the United States for the first time when she was just a few months old and has lived in this country full time since she was almost six. She has been approved for DACA, and she joins us now. Iridani, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You arrived in the United States as a young child to join your mother and stepfather who had applied for citizenship. Initially, you thought you could get citizenship when your grandfather or your stepfather was approved. But that process didn't work out for you. Why not? What happened?
Unfortunately, it hasn't fully gone through. It takes a really long time from sibling to sibling, which is how my father was going to be applying for his citizenship status. And the cutoff date is going to be around the time that I'm going to be turning 21. And so I no longer classify as a child. So my 21st birthday is almost coming up in January. And my dad's priority date is in March of 97. And it's all really just going to come down to the time. So hopefully we can get in there. And if not, there's always DACA.
In talking about that process, how long is the process supposed to take?
Mm-hmm. From sibling to sibling, it really just depends on priority dates. I know my dad was he was petitioned in 97, so it's been around 20 plus years to get his priority date to come up. But I know that, you know, depending on the cases, you know, if it's from spouse to spouse, it's a little bit of a faster process. And it just really kind of comes down to a waiting game, unfortunately, for all of the different cases.
Any sense of how likely it is his case will be approved?
It seems like it will be approved. We won't really have any problem for him, the only one that they're not really sure about is me. Yeah. My mom and my dad should be okay, but they're not sure if I'll make it by the deadline.
Are you feeling a certain squeeze with
all
of this?
Definitely.
What's the pressure like?
It's kind of scary. I've already talked to my parents about it, and even though they know that I have DACA and that that's a step forward, it's definitely going to feel a little bit different, you know, now my parents having their residency and then eventually being able to apply for their citizenship status while I'm still here, just kind of like in a limbo state. Mm-hmm. But that's why I told them I'm going to push them real hard for that citizenship exam so that they can petition for me.
At what point did you start to realize that the problems with documentation and such were going to limit your opportunities?
I definitely want to say it was around my sophomore to junior year of high school.
So you're about 16. Roughly.
Yeah, 16 or so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You had family members who urged you to consider moving back to Mexico, but you don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
It was something that I had to think about as the time approached after graduating high school. A lot of my family members asked me to move back and consider going to school over there because they thought my options were pretty limited. And at the time, being overwhelmed with the idea of not knowing exactly what my options were, it was something that I had to think about, but I wasn't able to fully commit to going back just because you grow up in a certain place and you're just accustomed to a certain lifestyle. And then I couldn't leave my family behind, so I decided to stick it out.
So it sounds from what you're saying as though, in many ways, Mexico is a foreign country to you.
Mm-hmm. It is. I don't have very many memories of it. I mean, it'd be nice to be able to go and visit and things like that, but I just don't know if I could actually see myself having a life there.
Mm-hmm. You had spoken about lifestyle. Getting used to a certain lifestyle. How would you articulate the things that you're comfortable with here, mm-hmm. living in the United States?
Well, for one, I guess security, because people always talk about the violence in Mexico and you know, how you're not able to do certain things, even wear certain things. I mean, I guess it kind of goes back to gangs here where you shouldn't wear certain things, but the way that they make it sound from like people who visit from Mexico is that it's a little bit more dangerous. And I mean, I guess also, you know, schools. Schools over there tend to be, most of them are private schools. And even maybe living situations are a little bit different. And the workplace, I know, I mean, my dad, you know, he's working here and everything's fine and we're able to pay our house. But in Mexico, I guess job opportunities are very limited. So,
and your immediate family is here.
Yes.
Do you have any siblings?
Yes, I have two younger brothers. Mm-hmm. They're both born here, so they're both citizens of the United States. Mm-hmm.
Now, also joining us is David and Sarah. He is a research associate with the Heritage Foundation. David and Sarah, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You have been critical of executive programs to prevent deportation of undocumented immigrants. On the other hand, we've just heard about Iridani's story, Iridani and her family trying to gain citizenship through proper channels. But the process is really, really tight right now because of time restraints. What do you say in a situation like that?
So I think that certainly people, especially in situations, dreamers and people who are subjects who are benefiting from DACA, there's certainly people who are in hard, difficult situations. And what we do need to consider are changes to the immigration system, but we need to do so congressionally. Congress is supposed to be the one who debates changes to our immigration system, which no one disagrees with. We need reforms to it. But Congress is supposed to be taking it up. For the president to unilaterally take action, it sort of defeats the whole constitutional checks and balances and the purpose of having different branches of government take make laws in another branch to enforce the laws. So I think right now we need to be putting the emphasis on Congress and how Congress can reform the system, not whether or not President Obama can use his executive power to just not enforce certain laws.
Yeah. Well, in theory, David and Sarah, it seems like the ideal solution. But in practice, in recent years, the speed with which Congress has moved on anything has been almost non-existent. I mean, it's got to make it even more difficult.
Sure, sure. But by not passing a law, Congress is still making its position clear. The will of the people's representative, whether you like it or not, is to not pass some sort of amnesty bill or some bill that would, change the immigration system. And so for the president to act, he's not only ignoring the current law, he'd be ignoring the will and the constitutional role of Congress. Just take, for example, imagine if Mitt Romney had won the election and he wanted Congress to lower taxes, but they wouldn't do so. But now imagine that Romney decided to unilaterally stop enforcing parts of the tax code just to effectively lower tax rates. I think most people on the left would be up in arms. And rightfully so, because after all, our presidents are supposed to enforce the laws, and Congress is supposed to pass and change them.
On the other hand, though, if there isn't some kind of a solution to help Iridanian people like her work or live legally in the United States, even if they're not citizens, what is the solution?
Sure. Well, I think first and foremost, we need to be talking about how can we better enforce our laws in this country. Right now, President Obama has unilaterally decided through things like DACA and other policy memos to not enforce large portions of our immigration law. And there's rumors that he's going to expand that to as many as 5 million people. So we're no longer talking small individual cases or small numbers of people. We're talking half of all unlawful immigrants. And so I really think that we need to get back to how can we faithfully administer the system that we have, and then we can have an honest debate about how do we fix the legal immigration system, because I know here at Heritage we do think that the legal immigration system needs to be fixed, but we need to first make sure that the existing laws are being enforced. Otherwise, we can't trust that any future laws will be enforced.
So, David and Sarah, what are the fixes you would like to see?
So some of the fixes I would like to see would include, let's make our immigration system, first of all, easier to use, simpler to use. Right now, some of it's still based on paper-based applications, which takes a long time to use and to process. They're trying to go electronic, but they've had trouble with that. Let's get a simpler, easier-to-use legal immigration system, first and foremost. Second of all, let's make our immigration more tailored to our economy. Right now, there are tons of people who want to work in the United States, who are often, they've often studied in the United States at U.S. colleges, but then they can't get a visa to work in the United States. I personally think that we should be looking for ways to bring and keep the best and the brightest from around the world and allow them to come here. Let's support the U.S. economy by bringing in these people who want to come here and who have skills and who have high levels of education. We would be silly not to take those folks. So those are just two reforms to the legal immigration system that I would like to make.
We are talking about the program known as DACA, which allows undocumented young people who were brought into the country as minors to work and drive legally. Yordani Sanchez lives in Las Vegas and has taken part in the program. We're also talking with David and Sarah, research associate for the Heritage Foundation. And we're joined now by Audrey Singer, senior fellow for the Brookings Institution. Audrey Singer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You've looked into the data on DACA, and the program was intended to help young people like Yordani. What are some of the benefits DACA recipients have reported 2 years into the program?
Well, the two major benefits at this point are the ability to work legally in the United States, because each DACA recipient gets a work authorization card. And the second is the relief from deportation. So these are people who will not be deported. There's an agreement now between them and the U.S. government. So those two things are the primary benefits. And then, depending on where you live, driver's licenses may be available, in-state tuition may be available, and other state and municipal level programs could be accessed.
So is the DACA program doing what it is supposed to be doing?
Well, it was primarily organized around the idea that there should be prosecutorial discretion when it comes to the people who are in U.S., living in the U.S. without status. And so the sense was that this is a group of people who have been here for most of their lives and who are most likely going to live out their lives here and are already part of our school systems and our social life and are contributing to their communities and could do better if they had the right to work and to move ahead. Now, this is a program that's temporary, so it's very limited in that sense. And, you know, as has been discussed, we really need more permanent solutions to the issues that we face today.
I'd mentioned in the introduction, Audrey Singer, that applicants are approved in Nevada at a lower rate than in some other states like California and Florida. Las Vegas has lower DACA approval ratings as well. That doesn't necessarily mean people are being denied, but they're not being processed as quickly here. What accounts for that?
Well, there's a couple things at play. One, I should mention that new statistics were released last week by USCIS, the agency that administers the program. And of the more than 11,000 applications in the state of Nevada that have been accepted, 87% have been approved. And that is on par with all applications in the U.S. So Nevada's not looking so far behind at this point. And that illustrates the fact that this is a program that's still in process, and it hasn't been completed, and there's no end date right now. So applications are coming in on a rolling basis, and the adjudication of and the decision-making around each application is also moving. So I think Nevada, when I look at the data, a lot of people applied a little bit later than in some of the places where we see higher approval rates, and that may be what's showing up in the data mm-hmm. over time. But again, we're not at the end, so we don't know ultimately how applicants in the state of Nevada will have fared relative to others.
Now, Audrey Singer, you have visited some cities with large populations of young immigrants. In cities where DACA approvals are close to that 100% figure, what kinds of supports are there for young people who use the program?
Well, it's very interesting because there's a lot of reasons that applications may either be in high numbers or high approval rates across the country. And that's what the Brookings DACA project is all about. We're trying to look at the variation in successes or failures across places. And so there's quite a few things that come into play. First and foremost, the role of nonprofits and community-based organizations and advocacy groups, along with municipal actors. And these are all groups that are in various ways supporting the enrollment in the program. But we also see variations in terms of the composition of the population that would be eligible. Age plays a big role. Country of birth plays a big role. terms of who is likely to apply for the program.
Iridani Sanchez, I'd like to get your take on the organizations here. Are there many places to turn for young immigrants who are seeking immigration help or even just a sense of community?
No, yes, definitely. I remember when I first applied for DACA, Hermandad Mexicana was the ones that were doing the application. So I went to them and they were very helpful in the process. And I'm also very fortunate to be a part of a great community organization called Mi Familia Vota. We don't have the DACA workshop itself, but we do have a Ya Es Hora, which is like the time for citizenship. So we have a citizenship workshop for eligible residents. And there are many other community organizations out there that are willing to lend that helping hand out to the younger folk in the community. And I think that that sense of community is very beautiful, especially for things like this, just because it's nice to see that there are other people out there that understand the situation that you're going through.
We are talking about DACA, the program which allows undocumented young people who are brought into the U.S. as minors to work here and in many cases to drive legally here as well. Iridani Sanchez lives in Las Vegas and has taken part in the program. We're also talking with David and Sarah, a research associate for the Heritage Foundation, and Audrey Singer, senior fellow for the Brookings Institution. David and Sarah, since the onset of DACA, more than 60% of recipients have gone on to get new jobs and driver's licenses. Why would it not be a good thing to get more people into the workforce, young people, that is?
I guess I would respond to that by saying that when we're looking at just individual cases, looking at just the DACA program, there are certainly some benefits to unlawful immigrants that they can take advantage of, but we have to consider some of the broader implications and harmful consequences of DACA. I think it's unfair to the other folks you were mentioning who mentioned the legal system before. There are millions of people who are waiting to come here legally, and they're waiting in line outside of the United States, and we're rewarding people who are here right now, but punishing the people who have to wait in line still. I also think that it encourages more illegal immigration. I think that's what we're sort of seeing on the southern border right now. I think that if you tell people that they can come here illegally and the United States won't enforce the law, that will encourage more people to come here.
And yet the reality, is it not, it would be that no president, no administration would deport all of the undocumented immigrants in this country. Even Mitt Romney said it would have to be self-deportation, mm-hmm. as term. Given that reality, isn't it better that these young people begin a working life at least?
I think that we need to look at ways that, you're exactly right, I think that we're not talking about going into communities and removing people, but I think we're talking about ways that when we come across people who are not authorized to be in the United States, that we look at ways to enforce the law. Because right now we're simply saying, well, we're guaranteeing you that we will not enforce the law against you. And I just think that sends the wrong message to future would-be illegal immigrants. And I don't, I prefer that we solve the problem now rather than set a precedent that we have to deal with this problem all over again in 10 or 20 years.
Audrey Singer, does it ultimately come down, as David and Sarah says, to ways to enforce the law effectively now so it doesn't get worse 10 or 20 years hence?
Well, we have had a long period of time between now and when we last changed our laws, like 25 years since we did a complete overhaul of our admission system and also the last legalization program, which was in 1986. So it's very hard for us to keep up with trends in demand for workers and in other worldwide events that influence who wants to migrate to the U.S. So I think there are a lot of things at play there, but one of the issues that has never been fully addressed is that workers, particularly those who are lower skilled, are in high demand in this country, and there aren't enough legal ways for them to enter. And so if they're not going to come in the front door, they're going to come in the back door. And that's what's been happening over the last couple of decades. The demand hasn't changed much, but the laws haven't changed to keep up with it as well.
Iridani Sanchez, speaking of changes and such, how has your life changed over the past couple of years since you received your DACA approval?
Well, I'm finally able to start driving, so it was definitely something new. I remember being in high school, all my friends getting their driver's permits, and where's yours? And it's like, oh, I haven't passed my test, or this, and but now I'm finally able to drive, so that's very exciting. And I'm able to continue my education, so I'm still going to school right now, and aside from that, I guess, you know, that sense of security that as long as I do my part in obeying the laws and, you know, I know a lot of people say, oh, yeah, but you already broke one of the most important ones by coming here, you know, mm-hmm. and things like that by overstaying a visa or whatever you may have. Right. But as long as I do my part, too, and, you know, I'm able to have a job. So I'm paying my taxes and I'm trying to do my part. I'm just grateful for that.
Well, David and Sarah is saying that you know, I think I'm paraphrasing accurately. It's saying that in effect, no enforcement. If we're not enforcing immigration law the way the law is written, it's just an open invitation to anybody to come into the United States, whether legally or not. Audrey Singer is saying many of the jobs that are being taken by many of these undocumented immigrants are jobs that need to be filled, but nobody else seems to be willing to take them.
Yeah.
Do you feel caught in the middle somewhere?
No, I think for that, I have a very clear standpoint on that one. I have to agree with Ms. Singer. I feel that a lot of the jobs that are kind of currently available are taken by maybe undocumented workers because, unfortunately, nobody else is willing to take them. And so they take those jobs. It's kind of one of those things that we talk about, an equal workplace, but... And to create those protections, you know, it's easier for employers to take undocumented workers who necessarily can't claim later on if they get hurt or something happens because they have that fear of them being undocumented and being potentially deported. So it kind of keeps them there, and employers are able to benefit from that labor.
Mm-hmm. Now, David and Sarah, DACA was intended to help young people like Iridani who grew up in the U.S. and don't really have a viable option of returning to the country of birth. Do you have concerns that this is a part of the problem of giving the impression that we've just got open borders? We're not enforcing any immigration laws at all? Are you worried that DACA could benefit people who are not meant to benefit from it?
I think there's always going to be, you know, some mistakes. There are always going to be some people who slip through the cracks, and that's always certainly a worry. But I think, you know, just more worried about the long-term trends about how we deal with illegal immigration in this country and the precedent that DACA sets. In terms of the labor question, which was just brought up, I agree that often, many times, illegal immigrants do not have access to many of the rights and protections of workers, and so that is a definite concern, which is why Heritage also supports using temporary work permits that do supply worker to businesses that need that labor when they need that labor in a way which better protects the workers, but at the same time doesn't necessarily mean that we have to allow, you know, unlawful immigrants to be that labor. And so I think there are better ways to improve the legal immigration system, to improve our enforcement of our laws that can get us to a place where the immigration system as a whole is supported and better than it is today.
If DACA were to be set aside by President Obama, tomorrow, next mm-hmm. week, do you think that Congress would actually begin to move on this issue?
Well, I think that as we were right now within, a close proximity of an election, I don't think that Congress has a lot on its plate to get done, and they got a lot to get done and very little time to do it within. Immediately, not necessarily. But I do think you see an appetite within Congress to at least consider these issues, different people coming from different sides. And I think if we were to focus on the things which everyone can agree on, fixing the legal immigration system would be one of those things. And so I think that we can have this conversation within Congress, and that's really the way it should play out.
At the same time, Congress will not pass any immigration reform right now. As you noted, it's an election year, so even things like the DREAM Act barely come up for debate, let alone passage. So how do you ask a generation of young people who are roughly Iridani's age to wait until Congress acts?
Well, I think I would... It's always tough in individual circumstances to say to specific people and to judge an individual case. And as a policymaker who's focused on the broad schemes of, you know, of immigration, like I said, I am concerned about the next generation that this will cause. We can be very worried about this generation, and we should consider what we can do for the current generation and what options are available. But if we do something which creates another generation, then we have only done a great disservice to our country. And so I think that debate needs to happen, and we can't be doing something just because we feel like we need to do something. Too many mistakes have been made just because we feel we just need to do something.
Audrey Singer, what are some of the obstacles that stand in the way currently of getting all eligible immigrants to apply for the DACA program?
Well, before I go there, do you mind if I
sure.
try to help answer that
sure.
other question?
Sure.
I think the real question about changing our immigration policy comes down to what happens when our elected officials are unable or unwilling to make decisions to change policy or even debate it. And that's the situation we've been in for over a year after the Senate passed an immigration bill. So that's a huge obstacle. And sure, the timing is never right, but this is something that we cannot really afford to waste any more time on. So given that it's House Republicans that are basically unwilling to step forward and to present something that might offer a solution, we're pretty much at a stalemate. But as to your other question about obstacles and barriers for young people who are eligible for DACA but are not applying, in the research that we're doing, there are a number of things that have cropped up that that sort of help contextualize this program. One is some potential applicants don't have the documents they need to pursue deferred action. They need to demonstrate that they've been present in the U.S. since 2007. So the older you are, the harder it is to document that continuous presence. Others don't have the money for the fees, at $465 an application. And that seems to be something that research is pointing to as an obstacle for some. Others have fear of turning themselves in, what it means for them and their future, what it means for their family. They realize this is a temporary program, and any president in the future could change it. Others are hoping for something longer term along the lines of a permanent legalization program. And then there's a third set of issues around perceptions, people that don't necessarily see themselves as potential beneficiaries of the program, even though they qualify for it or would be eligible. So they either don't know that they're undocumented or they don't identify themselves within the program. And that complicates outreach and service to a certain group of individuals.
So Audrey Singer, how do you think young people like Iridani Sanchez would be affected if the DACA program were to go away?
Well, I think there's strong support for DACA recipients. These are, by and large, people who've lived their entire lives in the U.S. and are Americans, you know, in every which way except on paper. And so there's support for this group. And I think it would be a really serious stain on American history if we were to turn our backs on this group or if we were to actively attempt to deport them. So I do think that there's some strength there. But they are tied to other people. They have family members. They live in communities. And the problem that we face today is so much bigger than them.
Mm-hmm. Iridani Sanchez, DACA is an executive order. It could be revoked by the next president come 2017. What will happen to you if that happens? You'll be over 21 by then. Your life circumstances will have changed a little bit. But what will happen?
Well, I'd like to think that I wouldn't get deported, but there's no guarantee for that one, is there? Especially because now the government knows that where you live, you know, you have to send in all this documentation. So now they know pretty much everything there is to know about you, your entire life. So at any given moment, that can all be taken away. But I'd like to not think about that right now. But I mean, if that, if worst case scenario, that's probably what would happen. And then I'd have to stop working. And then in terms of getting around the city or continuing going to school, that would probably get slim also, because if I can't get a driver out, a driver authorization card or whatever you may have in that specific situation, I can get pulled over by police, and then I can get detained, and it just kind of goes on from there. And I think it makes the situation gets worse instead of just getting a little bit better.
Iridani Sanchez is a young immigrant living in Southern Nevada who has used the DACA program. Audrey Singer is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and David and Sarah is a research associate at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.